You're listening to The Profile.
Welcome to The Profile podcast. God calls us to use our influence to share his love and goodness. For some, this is in leadership. I'm Andy Peck, and for the past 19 years, I've been interviewing Christians to find out how to lead better. Taking the initiative isn't always easy, so I hope you'll benefit from this latest conversation. The Profile podcast is brought to you by Premier Christianity magazine. Subscribe today and get full online access and the print magazine every month at premierchristianity.com.
The TV series Doctor Who seems to divide opinion. There are fans who can recite the names of every actor who's played the Doctor since the first episode in 1963 and eagerly await every episode. And then those who really can't abide the science fiction involved in the drama. But whether you like Doctor Who or not, there's a sense in which we are all time travelers when we open our Bibles. We go to a different time, in a different place, and a different culture. And part of the challenge of being a Christian is to read it correctly and interpret it for our day and generation. So I'm delighted to be joined today by a man who has made the understanding of the background of the Bible a key part of his ministry. He's been my guest before, but has now developed his ministry in exciting ways. His name is Mark Hendley, and he's the founder of The Stones Cry Out. And we spoke before about his guided tours of the British Museum in London, where he focuses particularly on the artifacts that give insights into different parts of Scripture and help any skeptics realize that what the Bible says is thoroughly backed by archaeological finds. He has since developed his ministry into other ways and has some fascinating background into the Christmas story that is sure to amaze your friends and which you can slip into a sermon if you happen to be preaching over the Christmas season. So great to have you back on the show, Mark.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with the challenging patch in your last season. It made perfect sense for someone who was talking about the Bible for the British Museum to set up a program of tours of Israel. So you all set up and ready to go. And then October 7th, 2023, Hamas attack Israel. 1,200 lose their lives, 240 taken hostage, and Israel is at war. That's an obviously awful conflict, but it also had impact upon you too.
Yeah, and actually it was only part of a chain of events. The story goes back a little bit further than that, actually. So 2018, I'd been doing the museum tours for a long time, and a good friend of mine said, hey, I've booked a tour in Israel. We'd love to take Eucharist at a number of the traditional sites there, but because they're quite traditional denominations that have stewardship of those sites, we need an ordained minister to be able to take communion together. Could you come and help us out with that? And I was like, well, yeah, sure, that's okay. So off I went to Israel and dutifully served in that way. And they had a local guide who was doing a lot of the speaking, but when he found out I was doing British Museum stuff, I kind of got pulled into a number of kind of teaching moments along the way. And it was just a wonderful moment, really, because I'd been so focused on the British Museum for a time that suddenly there was this, oh, wow, there's this new option. And so I then put in the diary to run one of my own trips there. And that was booked in for 2020, which, as you may know,
was COVID as well.
Yeah, so we've had COVID as well. So COVID was out of the way, and I thought, brilliant, we'll get something booked in. We finally got there in 22, having postponed twice. And then was having just some great conversations with the wonderful guys at the pilgrimage company that we were kind of using to do all our travel admin and whatnot. And just a realization that actually the traditional pilgrimage model to Israel is very church-based. You know, you go to the church of this, the church of that, and you're basically, you know, church hopping across the Holy Land, as it were, because over time Christians have built churches over important places. But there are so many more interesting places to go as well. And so I dreamt up this idea of doing more kind of text-driven tours rather than pilgrimage-driven tours. Still a spiritual journey of exploration and journeying with Jesus, but just kind of, you know, what about if we went to the Valley of Elah where David fought Goliath? We pace it out. We look at the stream where David got the rocks and so on, or we'll go to somewhere like Lachish, which is one of the most famous biblical archaeological sites in Israel. It's verified in the Bible. It's verified in the British Museum. You can actually go to the dig itself. So, you know, that was the idea. And so the Pilgrimage Company and I were working together on starting to build text-driven tours that were about deep diving into the story, but also engaging with God in those places. So something that was kind of home territory, I suppose, for the sort of charismatic stroke evangelical Christians. And then October the 7th happened. So I just started working with them. And it was an awkward phone call. Sorry, Mark, everything's on hold. And it was like, okay, this is interesting. I'd given up my bivocational work, which was sort of part funding the work I do, to focus more on the tours, and had a long think and pray and talk to my wife about it. And we just really felt God was saying, don't go back to bivocational, just use this as an opportunity to expand what you're doing. And so in the last year, just had phenomenal growth. And what's been the real gift is the opportunity to actually spend more time connecting with church leaders and Christians and sort of asking the questions about what are the kind of tools that we could produce that would help you. And so there's been a whole bunch of new developments off the basis of not being able to go to Israel.
I can imagine you're all ready to go. You feel God is in it. And then it seems as if God has a different plan, and you're starting to see maybe how the Lord is going to work in the next season.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, sometimes God takes you down a path because that's a really good lever to get you out of the old path. So, you know, I was kind of quite happy that things kind of weren't opening up in Israel. And because I made the decision not to go back to bivocational work, I just really felt with the Lord and talking with my wife and praying that actually this was an opportunity to finally say, you know, we're going to do Stones Cry out full time, as it were. That I had a lot of time and space to meet with Christian leaders. I'm connected into a number of sort of regional ministers, fraternals, and so on. But also the opportunity to talk to Christians about, you know, what kind of tools would really help you in the line of the kind of stuff we've done already, things like the museum. And I had some friends say to me, well, what about a virtual tour of Israel? Nobody's going to be going for a long time, and it's such a deep and moving experience. My one great fear was not wanting to reproduce the kind of classic 1980s, you know, come over to our house and watch our holiday photos on a, you know, projector. But I did some deep digging and some reading around biblical geography, and just there's a whole world that opened up that we are not really connected with because we are Westerners and we come with a particular perspective to the Bible. And because we're not necessarily literate in the Eastern way of thinking, there's a lot of stuff in there that we just miss. And so I ended up doing this, putting this one day seminar together called The Land of the Book, which is, you know, there are photos and, you know, let's explore the lay of the land. Israel is an incredible place. It's a quarter of the size of Scotland and has more geographical diversity than the British Empire at its zenith.
Wow.
And the problem is that most of the biblical epics we've ever watched or TV series about Jesus, you know, whether it's Robert Powell in Zeffirelli's Jesus of Nazareth, or whether it's, you know, The Chosen, or whatever's doing the rounds, you know, there's always budget constraints and there's always problems with geopolitics. And so, on the whole, the companies that film Jesus-type stories or Bible-type stories never film in Israel. So the first thing is just kind of giving people a really good lay of the land because it brings the stories to life. But also understanding that the biblical authors use geography to actually communicate very, very deep theology. And so we ended up with this wonderful one-day seminar that took everybody on a really deep dive and help them to just, when they come to the Bible, They might not be able to go to Israel, but when they open the Bible, A, they can visualize it, but B, they can see the really kind of sneaky, and I mean that in a good way, sneaky stuff the authors are doing to kind of tease theology out in the raw, in the real context and concrete scenario of the stories.
Mark, you have developed some material on the unseen realm, the supernatural dimension. It seems odd to be even asking the question because, of course, the Bible is a supernatural book. But too often Christians miss the supernatural and miss the kind of spiritual warfare dimension of it. Are you able to summarize in a few moments the kind of things you look at?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things going on. I suppose sort of going back to tier one thinking, it's simply this, that every time we open our Bible, and we sometimes forget this, when we open the front door of that front cover, we're traveling through time. We are about to orienteer across unfamiliar geography, but also we're entering a cross-cultural experience. And whether you like it or not, the chances are if you're speaking English and you are educated in English, then you are weird. And what I mean by that is you're Western, you're educated, you're industrialized, you're rich, you're democratic. All the things that the original people of the Bible just were not. And we bring all of that cultural baggage with us. Our world is essentially Western and it's shaped by the big Greek thinkers. You know, you think of all of those philosophers whose names we know well. And one of the things that Greek philosophy did was it was kind of carved the world in two. It separated the sacred from the secular. And we even see that in our Western gospel preaching is very much about, you know, believe in Jesus so you can leave this earthly realm and get to the heavenly one. But actually, if you're a Near Easterner, there is this union between the seen and unseen, that everything that's happening is not just happening in one dimension only, it's happening in both at the same time. So, you know, the great example is the prophet who's holed up in a city and his servant is freaking out because they see, you know, the massed armies of the enemy encamped around the city, and the servant's like, oh, what are we going to do? And the prophet's like, just hang on a moment. And God gives them this vision, kind of lifts the veil on the natural. And in the supernatural, there's all these, you know, horses and chariots of fire. And that's a classic story that kind of illustrates the way in which the Near Easterners saw the world. But we tend not to do that. And so a number of things have happened. I think, firstly, and hear me, I'm going to give a little caveat here. We have really great translations of our Bible in English, but they're always compromised in some way or another. And one of the things that tends to happen is that some Bible passages are demythologized. And what I mean by that, when you've got an option of how you could translate it, sometimes the supernatural elements are translated out. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so as a result, we read the Bible then in English and we miss that there's a whole bunch of stuff going on kind of under the surface. Coupled with that, you know, I'm talking about the land of the book days that we do, you know, in the Eastern world, they had this kind of idea of cosmic geography, that the geography of the physical earth is or has supernatural geography mapped over it. So a great example would be mountains or anywhere up. You know, if you're living in the Middle East, it's very dry, it's very hot, it's very dusty. So any place in high elevation gets precipitation, which means they tend to be places that have streams and rivers. That means there's green stuff growing there, which means it's full of animals. So really fertile areas. And so those kind of places were considered to be the places where the gods live. And you can see that in when the Israelites, for example, start worshipping foreign gods. Where did they do that? They worship in every high place and under every spreading tree. But actually, that is a biblical concept. You read chapter 2 of Genesis, and we're told that Adam is placed in a place called the Garden of Eden. And we miss the subtle clues, but Eden is not just a garden, but it's also a mountain. And we know that because there's four rivers that flow out of it to the four corners of the earth. So it has to be the highest placed on earth. And of course, what's in this garden? It's full of trees and animals and fruitfulness and so on. So that whole idea then gets picked up and it gets run across the rest of the Bible. So, you know, when Noah emerges from the flood, where does the ark rest? It rests on a huge mountain range, Ararat. And it's there that he makes intercession to God. And it's there that God says, I'm never going to flood the earth again. Or you roll forward to, I don't know, the giving of the law. Where does that happen? Oh, yeah, that's up a mountain. And Moses is told, hey, you know, everything you've seen here, I want you to replicate when you build this kind of portable worship space. And so the tabernacle itself is kind of pointing back to Eden, you know. It has kind of three zones to it. So you've got the world, you've got Eden, and then you've got the Garden of Eden. You've got the Holy of Holies is guarded by cherubim, just like the Garden of Eden has its gateway guarded by cherubim once Adam and Eve are kicked out, and so on. So you get this idea that actually the tabernacle is like this little analog pointing back and reminding mankind of the Eden experience. And that goes forward to the temple. And it goes forward to Jesus himself. You know, he says in John's gospel, you know, destroy this temple and I'll rebuild it in three days. So he's the mountain where heaven and earth now overlap because he's fully God and he's fully man. So, you know, there's all of these kind of ideas are littered through, but if you don't have the kind of vocabulary, because we've been so distanced from the ancient Near Eastern world, we kind of miss a lot of what's going on.
Mark, I hinted in the introduction that you have some insights into the Christmas story. And as we anticipate celebrating Christmas, there'll be some wondering, crumbs, what do I say that's new? Or what can I tell my friends that's new? So how does some of your work play into understanding and uncovering what's going on at Christmas?
Well, I mean, again, I think, you know, the Christmas story, as most of us know it, has been rewritten by Western culture. So, for example, you know, you pick up any Christmas card or, you know, you look at any kind of Christmas movie, guaranteed Mary and Joseph are shacked up in a wooden barn and little baby Jesus is laid in a wooden manger. And both of those ideas are a million miles away than the world of Israel and the world of Bethlehem. Israel in that part of the world, so sort of Jerusalem, Bethlehem, which is only a few miles away, there's huge amounts of limestone, which is why it's the central hill country. And so all of the buildings are made of limestone. Nobody builds out of wood. The only wood you have there is a crop, which is olive trees, and you wouldn't chop them down to build something because that's food. And so people lived in stone buildings or in caves. And there's, if you go to the Church of the Shepherds in Bethlehem, you can actually see one of these ancient caves that people would live in. And also mangers were not made out of wood. They were actually stone. They were limestone troughs. Now you may sort of think, well, okay, so what's the big deal about that? Well, there's this wonderful story about the shepherds who are the first people to hear about the birth of Christ. And they're told that he's going to be the savior of the world. And the sign of this will be that this baby will be wrapped in swaddling cloths and lying in a manger. And we kind of tend to interpret that as, you know, you found the right baby if he's wrapped in cloth and he's in this wooden trough. But a sign always points to something more. That's how signs work in sort of biblical prophecy. You know, there's a thing that happens now that points to a greater reality that is to come. And so they turn up and they find Jesus wrapped in cloth, lying in a stone bed. Well, if you telegraph to the end of Jesus' life, where do we find him? He's wrapped in burial cloths lying in a stone bed of the garden tomb. And it's like, oh,
absolutely wonderful. Yeah.
That puts a very different spin.
Yeah.
A very different spin on actually what the angel's saying when this will be a sign to you. because it was him lying in that tomb that essentially purchased our freedom, you know. So yeah, there's one example. I can go on if you'd like.
I understand you can potentially date the birth of Jesus as well because of where shepherds were at that point.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is one of the great perennial questions. When was Jesus born? Because there's a whole bunch of people who get really annoyed that it's on December, 25th, which makes it very close to certain pagan festivals and so on. And so it's a huge amount of debate. But the Bible is kind of narrows it down for us, and it's in a simple detail, which is that the shepherds, we're told, were out in the fields. Well, that sounds like a normal statement to us living in the West. In fact, my brother-in-law is a shepherd. So, he has fields on his farm and they're all fenced in, and that's where they keep the sheep. But in ancient Israel, in fact, pretty much as it is today, the world of the agrarian and the world of the shepherd are totally different domains. So the agrarians, they have fields. It's in all the fertile areas of Israel, so hill country and then down to the valley of Jezreel and so on, where you get all the sedimentary wash off and it's really fertile soil. They do not want sheep anywhere near their crops because they never had fences. You didn't fence in your fields like we do. And so the domain of the shepherd was predominantly the wilderness, which is why, David, when he writes, "The Lord is my shepherd," you read that carefully, it's clearly the wilderness that he's writing about, that God is providing and protecting him in this really rough and harsh environment. But there is one point in the year when the agrarians and the shepherds would meet on peaceful terms. And it was simply this: after the grain harvests, which would be barley early in the year and then wheat later in the summer, around October, November time, you get the first winter rains. So you want your new crop in the soil ready to go. And so what would happen is after the crops have been brought in at the end of the summer, the sheep are effectively invited into those fields to nibble on last year's stubble. And then whilst doing so, should we say, fertilizing the land. And that's the only time in the year when you get shepherds in the fields. And that traditionally is around September, September-ish time, which is, of course, is around the time when we get the Feast of Tabernacles played out, and that Jesus fulfills all the elements of the various feasts of Israel. So there's this kind of idea, as John says at the beginning of his gospel, that he made his home amongst us. He literally tabernacled amongst us. So I'm a big fan of a September dating, but you don't have to have it correct for it still to be the gospel, sure. But it's just interesting details that we overlook because of our kind of Western perspective.
That's fascinating, Mark. Thank you. That's going to thrill a number of people, I'm sure, and give insight. As you look forward, what are the kind of things that leaders might need to know about that they can connect with you on?
Yeah, well, I mean, the heart of Stones Cry Out is lifting the veil on time, space, and culture, because those are the three obstacles when we come to the text. So we have a number of things that we do. The British Museum is a wonderful 3D experience where you can see artifacts that paint clearly the backdrop of the biblical world, but in some cases are items that some of our biblical heroes would have seen and experienced in their lives, people like Esther and Nehemiah and so on. But they give a wonderful insight, and you never read the Bible the same once you've made that journey to the museum, because you get a real vivid and visceral kind of image of what that world was like. So that's one thing. But I'm starting to build together a whole bunch of one-day experiences that kind of either move on from that or run in parallel to it, that help these issues of time, space, and culture, which are so often stumbling blocks to us. So we have the Land of the Book, which is a really great virtual tour opportunity. So you can really kind of, when you're reading those stories, you can picture where they're happening, but you also see the subtleties of what the authors are doing with all of that sort of cosmic geography that we're talking about. I've put together another one-day experience called The Dust of the Rabbi, which is essentially, you know, so often we think of Jesus' incarnation in terms of God became man, but we forget the fact that God became a Jewish man who happened to be a rabbi. And so by studying a lot of the rabbinic culture in the century before Jesus and around the time of Jesus, you can actually understand a lot clearer some of the things that Jesus is teaching and some of his methodology and why he's doing things a certain way, the idioms he uses and so on. So this is a kind of spotlight to understand the Gospels at a much deeper level. We've just run one of those. We're running them again in the new year. And people really had some profound encounters with God during those days, which was just wonderful to kind of help facilitate that journey that we took folk on. And then over the coming future, I have a number of things that are kind of cooking in the pot, as it were. This idea that our culture as Christians in the West is very much shaped by the Greeks, but the book that gives us our faith is actually framed in a Hebrew mindset. I'm going to be putting together a day's material to help us kind of disentangle a little bit from our culture and engage a bit more with the way the Bible is talking to us and the kind of things that it's addressing, because we almost have cultural blind spots to that. So that it's kind of getting the grease out of the wheels, as it were, putting the Hebrew in. So that's one thing.
Well, Mark, it's terrific to hear, and Christians in leadership need to be feeding themselves, and it sounds like you've got some rich food available. So the website where people need to go to discover more?
Yes, it's simply thestonescryout.org.uk.
Brilliant, Mark. Well, thrilling to chat with you. I'm so glad that you've been able to navigate this last season, a challenging season, and that God's brought you through into what for you will be very much a promised land. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
It was super to chat with Mark Hendley, H-E-N-D-L-E-Y. Maybe you know very little that will help you in your time traveling as you open your Bible. So do connect with him at his website, thestonescryout.org.uk. As always, good to learn how God has been helping Mark to navigate a tough season. And the outcome now is maybe better than it would have been had his plans gone as he'd hoped. So as you navigate your journey of life and perhaps face hostile or tricky situations, may you see God's hand turning things for good like Mark did. So this is Andy Peck, thanking you for your company, looking forward very much to the next time. Bye for now.
The Leadership Show with Andy Peck. To get in touch, email andy.peck@premier.org.uk.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.